Welcome to Sleep Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, here with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hello, hello.
We're here with Elizabeth Spires, who just wrote a column for the New York Times about Cybertrucks.
Hello.
We have a Slate Plus about Elon and superchargers and that kind of stuff. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about marijuana, which might become a big branded industry or might not. There's news on that front. We are going to talk about CZ, the Bitcoin billionaire who is now looking like he's going to prison for 4 months. We are going to talk about ravioli and stuff and the price thereof. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast, like Slate Money? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
We are going to talk about marijuana today because a whole bunch of states have legalized it, but it didn't matter that it was legal in a whole bunch of states because it was illegal in a class one classified something something federally, which basically meant that, like, no one could set up a functioning marijuana business because there was a whole bunch of interstate commerce involved. And all of that great marijuana stock market bubble boom thing that we saw in 2018 completely fizzled out. We just saw the bankruptcy of MedMen, which was one of the big companies in California. And just after the entire industry seems to have fizzled into a nothingness, the federal government comes along and says, well, maybe we can change something.
Yep. Deft summary from you, Felix. Well, what happened this week was the Biden administration said essentially it wants to demote marijuana from being a Schedule I drug. That's the most dangerous kind of drug with no accepted medical use, with high potential for abuse. A Schedule I drugs are like heroin and LSD. So it wants to demote marijuana to Schedule III, which is, you know, moderate to low potential for abuse. That's like Tylenol with codeine or anabolic steroids, stuff like that.
Or if Elon Musk is listening, ketamine.
Yes. And Elon's beloved ketamine, I suppose. And that's great news for the industry because it means if it actually happens, and to be clear, it has not happened yet. A lot of rulemaking has to happen. Maybe there'll be lawsuits. Who knows in these times? But if it does happen, then marijuana companies can finally start getting these tax deductions and tax credits they weren't able to get before. Some in the industry saying they were paying like a 70% tax rate without those deductions and credits, which seems bad.
Like, to be clear, like, you know, we're calling this a tax deduction. The idea is basically just that if you're a business, you pay tax on your profits, mm-hmm. and your profits are your revenues minus your expenses. And mm-hmm. the thing that marijuana companies aren't allowed to do is the minus the expenses bit, which kind of just means you're paying tax on your revenues, which is wild.
Yeah. So anyway, so the industry is excited about that. And then I think the industry then hopes that other stuff will start happening. There's this SAFER Act that's been bouncing around for a long time, which would give these companies access to actually the banking system, which they kind of don't have right now. They can only use state
chartered banks, a few like local credit unions. Basically, it's really, really difficult to get a bank account if you're a marijuana company. The other thing which is really, really difficult is to just accept payments. You know, one of the basic mm-hmm. things you need to do if you are selling something is have some payment system that allows you to accept payment for the thing that you are selling. And all of the big payments companies are like, marijuana? No, thank you. As far as I know, it's almost impossible to pay for marijuana with a credit card anywhere, just because, you know, Visa and MasterCard and Amex are like, no way. Even paying with a debit card can be like rather complicated. You wind up seeing these stores, you know, which basically just have cash machines in them. And they're like, well, if you want to pay for it, you have to take your debit card and then get cash out and then pay in cash. And so that also maybe might be loosened up. But again, like at the end of the day, this is something that the payments companies need to decide. Even if the drug gets changed and even if this SAFER Act or whatever gets passed, the payments companies could still err on the side of caution and say, yeah, why take the risk?
Yeah, I mean, I had a cannabis client a couple of years ago, and their company in Colorado called Ripple, and pot is legal in Colorado. And the sheer number of just bureaucratic hurdles they faced trying to do everything right was so ridiculous and cost prohibitive because, you know, as you mentioned, they had trouble getting banked. And part of the reason for that, too, is that a lot of institutions have institutional investors who just will not tolerate the risk of anything that they think is a vice-oriented business. And as long as pot was a Schedule I drug, it was. If it's not legal at the federal level, it's still considered risky by a lot of those people. But another big roadblock was that when you were dealing with local regulations or even trying to make an argument to the federal government that pot should be rescheduled or made legal generally, they would always throw their hands up and say, well, there's not enough research on pot. But the reality is, if you want to do FDA approved research, the hurdle to that is you can only buy marijuana from the University of Mississippi. And even then, you're buying freeze-dried pre-rolled joints, some of which are 20 years old, and testing that against, say, if you're a company that produces gummies or, you know, soluble CBD, that's just not relevant to your product. And so there was this kind of vicious cycle of nobody having the research, regulators not wanting to deal with it because there wasn't enough research, and then all of the structural things that we were talking about.
So, Elizabeth, like, does this... I mean, I guess the two questions. The first one is it the FDA which ultimately needs to sign off on this proposal from the administration? When Emily says a bunch of rulemaking has to happen, is it the FDA that is doing the rulemaking? And given that this proposal is now out there, does that mean we can assume that they have whatever kind of empirical research they need in order to make this determination?
Well, it's going to take time, and it's going to be, you know, multifactorial. So it's not just the FDA. It sort of also depends on what happens in Congress.
Oh, wait, Congress needs to do something for this to happen?
Well, the SAFER Act is a piece of legislation. And the idea is that it loosens banking restrictions so that companies can, you know, bank cannabis companies. And so all these things are kind of interrelated.
Okay, so there are two things which are happening here. One is the moving from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, and then the other one is the possible passage of the SAFER Act. And I guess that if it's moved from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, then the Senate would be more likely to pass the SAFER Act. Is that the kind of logic?
There's the banking lobby would be more amenable to it, because then it's just considered lower risk because it's not Schedule I. So there's kind of a domino effect.
Okay, so that's like downstream. If this happens, then one yes. of the advantages, along with being able to deduct expenses and stuff, is also that it becomes easier to do research and get FDA approval for medical
yeah.
use. Okay, all right.
And it just kind of de-risks all the way around because it makes the financial institutions that are involved in the ecosystem a little bit more willing to work with cannabis companies. I mean, the ideal thing is that federal or cannabis gets legalized federally, but yeah.
So is that something that you like, that we know the financial institutions will be more willing to do this? Or is this just something that we kind of infer that might happen?
Well, generally, they have much higher tolerance for working with companies that produce Schedule III drugs than Schedule I drugs, because those are just, you know, just totally different ballgame in terms of the approvals that you need and the amount of regulation.
Got it. Because, like, if you go back to when we had the first stock market bubble in marijuana stocks, nearly all of which were Canadian for, you know, very similar reasons that, like, no one wanted to list marijuana companies on U.S. stock exchanges. Back then, that bubble was all driven by the idea that if and when marijuana was legalized, the whole marijuana industry would move from being illegal to being legal, that it would start becoming branded in much the same way that alcohol and cigarettes are branded, that it would start generating enormous tax revenues in much the same way that alcohol and cigarettes generate enormous tax revenues, and that we would have this whole new sort of tax revenue stream in a big new legal industry. And where we are right now, that clearly hasn't happened. The tax revenues that everyone hoped for from legalization have been kind of meh, partly because exactly what you're saying, that the obstacles to doing this legally are so great that people just wind up continuing to do it illegally anyway. That the illegal marijuana trade is probably as big as it ever was. And as all of us who live in New York can attest, you know, the illegal marijuana trade is right out in the open on every single block. There are illegal marijuana stores. And that, you know, barely generates any tax revenue at all. And so I guess one of my questions is, if you just get this rescheduling, does that then open the gates to this sort of brave new world of everything becomes legal, everything becomes regulated, lots of tax revenue and all the rest of it? Or at this point, is it just the case that things are these things are path dependent, and we're so far down the road of this incredibly sort of balkanized, weird, messy industry that the sort of branded consolidation is just not a thing that's going to happen?
I think it's been both fast and slow, this march towards legalization. And you're sounding very down on the industry, and you're almost painting a picture of this never really happened. But if you step back and zoom out, I mean, right now, the Washington Post recently reported that more than half of Americans live in places where recreational marijuana is legal. I mean, this drug has gone from something, you know, you buy, you know, from some weird guy who comes to your apartment that you don't know, to something you buy in colorful packages with clear labeling in stores. I mean, it's gone from underground black market to something else. It's not fully, what is the opposite of black market?
It's green gray market.
It's not fully.
It's a gray market.
Free market. Gray, whatever. It's not there yet, but it's probably more than halfway there. And here we have just like another incremental step on the way to that pot utopia that, you know, the brands wanted to see in 2018. Like, I bet you, when we're like 70 and we're still doing Slate Money episodes, we'll be talking about some like big antitrust case against a marijuana company that's taken over, or, you know, Amazon wants to buy one. Do you know what I mean? I think it's just going to take some time.
There's already an existing model for this, and it's the alcohol industry. And I think that's what a lot of, you know, cannabis C-level executives hope happens. But right now, just lifting some of the restrictions would help with branding and consolidation. Like, mm-hmm. Right now, you can't advertise cannabis over any social media platform. So if you just look at the alcohol industry as a comparable, it's not like we have to reinvent the wheel to figure out how to regulate this kind of substance. So
no, the regulation point is not the sticking point, right? But like, as I say, like the dream of the kind of branding that we see in alcohol and cigarettes, the dream that, you know, we could have cannabis brands alongside, you know, Grey Goose and Marlboro, is the age-old dream from circa 2018. And that was the dream of MedMen, right? They were one of the big companies that was going to be like one of the household name cannabis brands. They just filed for bankruptcy. I kind of get Emily's idea that we are moving in that direction slowly, and that the sort of branding and advertising future is bound to arrive eventually. But given how little progress we've made in that direction so far, I'm not holding my breath.
Another big difference is just that I think it will increase access to capital markets, which was a big problem for cannabis companies in 2018, 2019. And also part of the reason why Canadian companies were doing relatively better. Those were the companies that were snapping up smaller cannabis operations and consolidating and then going public.
I mean, there are a bunch of publicly traded cannabis stocks in the United States right now. By definition, if you're a publicly traded company, you know, like Canopy or Tilray or something, you have access to capital markets. That's what that means. The problem is that the stock prices are so low, they you know, the cost of equity is prohibitively high, and they still have real difficulty with the basic thing here, which is making money.
This step this week is an incremental step towards these companies making money. I mean, why do we want big brands? Like, we spent how many episodes talking about antitrust and big companies bad and bad for competition? Seems like we have a lot of little companies here, and there's a lot of competition.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay.
And I think people, I do think this is true. And like, there is something weirdly illogical about, you know, vodka brands, right? There is something weirdly, like, vodka is a commodity, and what you are paying for when you buy vodka is purely branding. And this was like the dream of the capitalists entering the marijuana space, was like, we can buy a bunch of commodity marijuana and then wrap it in a pretty brand and sell it at a massive premium, just like Grey Goose.
I know a lot of Russians who would disagree with you about that. But
I'm kind of with Emily on this one, that like, is that something that is that society like needs or wants? If the Americans who are happily getting high are happily getting high on commodity marijuana, and they don't feel the need to pay a premium for the marijuana equivalent of Grey Goose, and you don't have a bunch of branding and Philip Morris doesn't wind up getting into this industry, then that's good.
Yeah, who wants Philip Morris branded weed? Like, ew.
Innocently they dance, innocent of a new and deadly menace lurking behind closed doors. Marijuana, the burning weed with its roots in hell.
Slay Money is sponsored this week by Shopify. If you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from launching your online shop to having your first real-life store, all the way to hitting a million orders. Shopify is there every step of the way to help you grow. You might be selling scented soap or outdoor outfits. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person point-of-sale system. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. It helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., plus its award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/money, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/money now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/money.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Let's move on from marijuana to another thing that is ostensibly legal, but that seems to be caught up in all manner of illegal activity, which is crypto. In the wake of Sam Bankman-Fried getting 20 years sentence for his crimes.
25 years.
25 years. We now have his great rival, CZ of Binance, getting 4 months for admittedly much less criminal crimes. Like, he didn't steal anyone's money. He was never accused of anything Ponzi-ish. Basically, he was just basically accused of ignoring U.S. Bank Secrecy Act and anti-money laundering and whatnot regulations, when most of the time he wasn't even operating in the U.S. But the U.S. is famous for applying its laws globally. And CZ famously just said, you know, we can't grow to become the biggest crypto exchange in the world while adhering to SEC laws in a country where we don't even operate. All of this came to a head with a big settlement where Binance paid $4.6 billion and CZ flew to the United States voluntarily, turned himself in and said, okay, you can put me up for criminal trial. And at that point, things start getting interesting because there were two opinions at that point. One was he would never do this. He is quite possibly the richest man in the world. He would never do this and voluntarily, like, fly in from Dubai and appear in a U.S. court unless he had a nod and a wink from the Department of Justice basically saying, if you do this, we will fine you, we will do all manner of things, we won't actually send you to prison. Another view was he did terrible things, he needed to hand himself in, and he was likely to get, like, 2 years. In the end, he got 4 months, which is, you know, a very unpleasant stay in prison for a multi-billionaire. But Emily, what's your opinion? Do you think he kind of expected that this might happen when he flew to the United States in the first place?
I think that's maybe true. I mean, there's some reporting about deals that he made with U.S. authorities to help them track down other terrorist groups, things like that. But it's not really known. There's some sealed secret stuff presented at trial. So I feel like, yeah, probably he felt comfortable coming here because there were these deals going on that haven't been made public. But I think that's a reasonable assumption to make, but we're not going to know for sure.
His defense team was asking for 30 days instead of 4 months, and the prosecution was asking for 2 or 3 years.
The defense team was asking for zero, to be clear. The defense team was very clear, like, saying this is a custodial sentence is not warranted, and they wanted a non-custodial something.
That's true, but whenever they were in the negotiation process, they were asked, making an argument for 30 days. And I think that indicates that they always kind of knew that jail time was a possibility, at least.
I guess my question for Emily is, like, when he turned up, Emily, do you think that he thought that he was likely to go to prison?
I think that he thought he was not likely to get a harsh sentence because of some sealed matter. Right. I read a piece in Fortune about this, quote, sealed matter that the judges and the lawyers knew about, but was sealed. So we don't know what it was, but one assumes, I mean, to pull back, CZ was accused of letting, like, Hamas and, you know, other terrorist groups launder money through Binance. So it stands to reason that Binance knows a lot of stuff about a lot of bad guys doing a lot of nasty business. If they're sharing that information with the feds and CZ, and they had some conversation with CZ about doing that for the next few years, which I think we talked about on another episode recently. Yeah, it stands to reason there was some kind of deal going on and he felt comfortable enough with that happening to come here and sort of get this over with, kind of a thing, so he can go on being a rich person.
If he had known with certainty that he was going to get a 4-month sentence, do you think he would have done what he did and flown to the United States and gone to trial?
I mean, I don't know that answer about anyone.
CZ's best friend,
much less this dude. I mean, did he think he was going to get no prison time or 30 days? And that's why he came back. And if he had known it was 4 months, he wouldn't have come back. I mean, he must have known it was a crapshoot when you go in front of a judge. You know, the judge does have discretion to sentence, right?
I guess the reason I'm asking is because one of the arguments that the prosecution made was basically most people, if not everyone, would happily go to prison for 4 months if it meant they could be worth hundreds of billions of dollars.
Here we go. Yes, let's get into it.
And I guess, like, do you agree with that?
Would most people agree to go to prison for 4 months, and when they got out, they would be a multi-billionaire? Yes, I think most people would agree to that. Yes, I will say on the record that I would agree to that.
I think if for me, it would be which kind of prison am I going to, like Martha Stewart prison or, you know, maximum security prison? And I think if it were the latter, I agree with that.
No, and the answer, we actually have an answer to that. That's not a hypothetical question.
We have an answer.
The answer is that you do not get to go to a minimum security prison because you are a foreign national and only U.S. nationals are allowed in minimum security prisons.
4 months. It's not that long. You know, as you get older, you realize time flies. And 4 months in prison, I mean, what's that? It's a season.
The counterfactual is also an interesting one, which is basically, what is CZ's life like if he remains in, you know, Dubai and Singapore and places like that and doesn't hand himself in? And the answer is that he basically spends the rest of his life worrying about possible extradition and knowing that if he does, you know, set foot in a country where he then gets arrested and then gets imprisoned pending, or sort of jailed rather, pending extradition, and then gets extradited and then gets sentenced, that sentence is certain to be much harsher because he's no longer cooperating. So rather than spend his entire life as a fugitive from U.S. justice, which is a kind of unpleasant way to spend your life, you get your prison sentence over with and then you are 100% free, you've served your time, and you can travel any way you like, and you don't need to worry about, you know, the U.S. authorities anymore.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, it's hard to live a life with something hanging over your head like that. You know, every day there's that little bit of anxiety eating away at you. Feels good to just...
Yeah. Also, if you're a fugitive, I would imagine that would put you in a lot of danger because it's not like you have government protection from the people who would be normally most likely to protect you.
Hmm.
So what do we think about the sentence? Is it a condign punishment for his crimes?
I don't know how I feel about the sentence per se. Like, I feel like we've talked a lot recently about it's too much time in prison, you know, with SBF, 25 years, too much, too little, whatever. What I'm enjoying is just the movie potential of the CZ Sam Bankman-Fried rivalry, because it's such an amazing story. You know, these were two guys, crypto guys, sort of at the top of their games. They had this rivalry. And then CZ just topples Sam Bankman-Fried. He just...
With like three tweets, he brings down the entire FTX empire.
Right? And then you have to imagine SBF maybe is watching then CZ like be pursued on his own charges. And he's like, aha, now he's going to get taken down the way I was. But not really. No, he get 4 months compared to 25 years. Like, he emerges with all his money.
As a rivalry narrative, I think Michael Lewis has said this, that this is what he initially thought that he was writing when he started following SBF around. He thought that he was writing, and he said this in an interview, that he thought he was writing a Darth Vader versus Luke Skywalker type, you know, white hat versus black hat tale of where SBF was the white hat, to be clear, where SBF was like the good guy who was doing, like, you know, the clean cut American kid who was doing everything for charity, and CZ was this shady foreigner who was, you know, hoovering up a whole bunch of dodgy crypto money and doing, you know, illegal things with it. That was the movie treatment that Michael Lewis thought that he was writing before suddenly, you know, there's that big heel turn at the end. And it turns out that SBF was much, by far, the larger crook all along.
Yeah, he was stealing people's money.
Yeah, the difference between what they did is so momentous. It's the CZ basically did not provide the level of oversight that you're supposed to for the kind of company that Binance is, but also in an industry that's not as heavily regulated as it probably will be eventually. But it's kind of the difference between, you know, a minor lie of omission and then lying your face off about everything.
And it's also the difference between, you know, allowing crypto to crypto versus actually stealing people's money.
Yes,
exactly. Yes.
But I do think, you know, he said something There was a quote from him where he said something like, better to ask for forgiveness than permission, which is such a cliched Silicon Valley thing. I've heard that from lots of tech CEOs. And some of it's just the culture of tech, which is that, you know, we fix mistakes after they happen, or after the market tells us they're bad or somebody tries to sue us. So I'm sure he understood that there was some risk baked into what they were doing and, you know, failing to have oversight with these things when they made those decisions.
But by the same token, you know, the person who most famously had an entire business model of ask forgiveness rather than permission was Travis Kalanick at Uber, who never went to prison for anything.
Although some people think he should have.
many people think he should have. But like, you know, if you look at the precedents, if you're CZ and you are not even operating in the United States, and when you do start operating in the United States, you do it very, very carefully through a company called Binance US that you try very hard to dot all the I's and cross all the T's. You're like, you know, if Travis Kalanick can just be out there in the United States breaking all the laws and people are like, tut, 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 why would they, like, the full force of the law come after little old foreign me? You know, I think there was a kind of sea change a couple of years ago where the U.S. government, the DOJ, various attorneys general did just really start cracking down on crypto in particular in a way that was kind of unexpected, given the way in which they hadn't been cracking down on it previously.
I think also, I mean, I don't know if Travis is the right parallel. Like, don't banks get into trouble for violating some of the for doing some of the things that CZ did, right? For like banking, you know, sanctioned people from sanctioned governments, they don't go to jail.
But exactly, like the $4.6 billion fine that Binance paid, we can think of many fines in the wake of the financial crisis that banks paid, which were on a level with that sort of, you know, multi-billion dollar fine thing. That happened. JP Morgan has paid more than $4.6 billion in fines, you know. Wells Fargo has paid more than $4.6 billion in fines. But Jamie Dimon is not being, you know, criminally prosecuted.
Yeah, so that actually, if you pull back and look at that comparison, it is kind of surprising that CZ would wind up in jail for this when bank CEOs would never, ever.
Digital currency kind of operates in the shadows. There's a lot of stories about drug dealers using these kind of things. It's not regulated. It's not controlled.
I can assure you, if these became well promulgated, then the U.S. government would shut it down.
This episode of Slate Money is brought to you by ZBiotics. There is now a game-changing product to use before a night out with drinks. It's called ZBiotics. Let's face it, after a night with drinks, it's tough to bounce back the next day. You have to make a choice. You can either have a great night or a great next day. ZBiotics is a surefire way to wake up feeling fresh after a night of drinking. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Go to zbiotics.com/money to get 15% off your first order when you use money at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/money and use the code money at checkout for 15% off.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
This episode of Slate Money is brought to you by Wondery. which is a podcast company, and it makes a podcast called The Best One Yet, and it is a daily podcast hosted by Nick and Jack, who serve up three of the most interesting business news stories every day and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? That's the kind of stuff you find on The Best One Yet. So be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business. Emily, what is the problem with ravioli?
Thank you very much for asking, Felix. To quote this piece from Jezebel by the wonderful Sophie Vershbo, I hope I said that right. Ravioli's day of reckoning has arrived. We're here to discuss what happens when you order ravioli at a restaurant, especially like a relatively nice one. And Felix can go into more detail about the super fancy restaurants.
Oh, you mean Union Square Cafe?
Yes. Basically, you go to a restaurant for a meal. You want your dinner and you order your entree, and your entree is ravioli, and out comes like four ravioli.
Or in the case of Union Square Cafe, one raviolo.
One.
If you look at the menu, it actually says raviolo, singular.
Incredible. So
you have to know what you're expecting when it just says raviolo.
Not everybody speaks Italian.
But I feel like this is just on one level empirically true, and on another level just clearly empirically false. Like it is obviously true that the number of ravioli you get when you go to a restaurant is small. But it is also empirically false that the day of reckoning has arrived. There is no reckoning. There will be no reckoning.
Well, I mean, we're having a conversation about it, and maybe a restaurateur is listening and says to himself, I will offer more ravioli, or I will provide you with the ability to order extra ravioli, or something like that. And so begins the revolution.
Also, we should mention that the reason why we're talking about this is the single raviolo at Union Square Cafe is $38. And that's part of the reason why the writer was like, you know, if I'm going to pay $40 for ravioli, plural.
Well, that's because she's just not reading the menu, right? If she's reading the menu, she can see that it says raviolo. She shouldn't. This is no bait and switch.
That's fair. But I think if I saw that on a menu, I might assume it was a typo.
The solution to this problem is that we have to get out of the iron grip that Italian food has on American restaurants and make ourselves more open to like Swabian and South German food, because the South Germans have this amazing thing called Maultaschen, and Maultaschen are the most delicious things in the world. And you might not have many more of them than you have ravioli, but they're much more filling and much more delicious. And we should all just be eating Maultaschen instead of the ravioli.
I have another ravioli theory, though, and it's that normally, you know, if you are in Italy at a nice restaurant, you order pasta and you get it's you know, a course. It's not a giant entree.
Exactly.
But, you know, if you're in Carmine's in Times Square, you get something the size of your table. And I think it's sort of led people to believe that, you know, if you order pasta at a restaurant, you should be getting some giant thing in a platter.
Well, Olive Garden has the endless pasta, right?
Does it?
Bottomless. They have breadsticks. I'm wrong.
No, I think Elizabeth is exactly right about this, that the correct, true, and godly way to eat pasta is as the middle course in the holy trinity of antipasti, pasti, main, right? And so the whole point of the pasta course is that you get the antipasti to begin with, and you have like that little interregnum of pasta, which is delicious but not particularly filling, and then you have your main course. And somehow the Americans have forgotten that there's an entire course that's meant to happen after the pasta, and so they have like a starter and then a pasta, and then they expect to be full. And of course, that's just going to like no.
But Felix, we were going to talk about.
Yeah, I was going to say why we were talking about this in the first place.
Okay, the reason we are talking about this in the first place is that because Amanda Mull has written another piece for The Atlantic, and there's some rule that, that says that whenever Amanda writes for The Atlantic, we have to talk about it on Slate Money. And basically what she says is, oi, look at all of this cheap crap that people are buying on Temu and Shein and the TikTok store, and the amount of just utter junk that Americans are buying is not going down. It is going up. And what the actual fuck? And the connection to ravioli is basically that for the price of a single raviolo at Union Square Cafe, you can get onto the TikTok shop and buy just a shit ton of junk that gets shipped to you from China. And on a comparative value basis, it might be junk, but it's still probably, you feel it's more valuable than a single raviolo.
Like, how many fake Yeezys could you buy on Temu for a single Union Square raviolo?
Exactly.
You feel
also,
but
services,
all that consumerism makes you empty inside, and the raviolo might fill you up.
Except for it doesn't, because there's only one of it.
Dopamine, right?
Also, I think we were also talking about how experiences are more expensive now. So maybe people are just filling the experience void with crap that you can buy online.
I mean, shopping has long been an experience in the United States. Like, we shop as an activity, right?
Well, do we? I feel like that's the thing that we don't do anymore. Like, the idea of going to the mall as, like, the fun thing to do at weekends has been in many ways supplanted by the experience of doom-scrolling Temu and ordering a bunch of stuff just because you have a void in your soul.
Well, also, our producer, Tina, pointed out that TikTok may be driving some of this, because there are a lot of people who watch these restocking videos and unboxing videos where they convince you that you need 4 million things in your pantry and they should all be sitting in glass jars that are perfectly labeled. And it may lead people to overbuy all of these things,
which are easily accessible in the TikTok shop, available just a click away. I mean, the TikTok shop is really, you know, I think it's still losing money, but the volumes are insane on that thing already.
And I thought one thing was interesting in the Amanda Mull piece, you know, where she's lamenting, will we ever get sick of cheap junk and we're buying so much cheap junk? Half of the people who are shopping in the United States on Temu make over $130,000 a year. So it's like wealthy people or relatively high income people who are buying all the cheap junk.
Because they have the disposable income to buy a bunch of cheap junk they don't need. If you are living paycheck to paycheck, you don't have like disposable income to buy cheap junk you don't need. This makes perfect intuitive sense to me.
Yeah, you don't need if you're really poor, you're not going to spend your money on jars to put the food that you can barely afford into.
Temu is not like the dollar store. It's not the place you go, you get your necessities. I mean, you like the thing about if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you need to buy something, one of the things you need to do is have the thing that you buy when you buy it, because that's why you're buying it, rather than the Temu experience of you put in an order and then it arrives sort of 7 weeks later after you've forgotten that you even ordered it.
Right. Right. So that makes sense that rich people shop on Temu, even though it's the cheapest place.
But this is an interesting corrective to the discourse that we have stopped buying stuff and we're just buying experiences. It turns out that we are still buying stuff, and the amount of stuff that Americans buy, they're just insatiable.
Also, with regards to experiences and stuff, we talked before the show about the price of experiences is getting really expensive, and I was under that impression. Like, every time I've tried to buy like concert tickets or stand-up comedy tickets, anything, I'm always like, wait, what? $400 a ticket? $500? But I was looking at, the Journal has been covering this pretty closely, and in Amanda Mull's piece, she says the price of like consumer goods is up 20% from pre-pandemic. And then this other Journal piece I was reading said the price of experiences are basically up 20% from pre-pandemic. So I wonder if when we say experiences have gotten more expensive, we're just cherry picking like Taylor Swift tickets.
We're over indexing on Beyonce.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there was inflation in both categories. And I think maybe we're just continually surprised by how much things cost in general.
I think that there's also a kind of, you know, media elite thing going on where things like Union Square Cafe meals and tickets to the San Diego Zoo, you know, which have also just gone up to like $69 or something.
See, yeah. There it is.
Exactly. Like that's where you get the sticker shock. But then your broader experience economy, you know, the cost of a cruise or whatever hasn't actually gone up that much from pre-pandemic. Cruises were always kind of expensive.
Hmm. Do you guys shop on Temu?
I don't.
I looked around, but I couldn't find anything I wanted.
You see, but that's the whole point. It's not a question of what you want. You just do it to fill the aching void at the heart of your soul, Emily.
No, I'm all for that. I just, there's other sites better at that, I think.
Also, the Temu app looks like a sort of badly designed video game, and it's just all pop-ups and craziness. So it really does cater to the impulse buyer who is looking for a tiny dopamine hit from buying, you know, something for a dollar.
Right? And then waiting 3 months for it? Like, no, thank you. I need it tomorrow.
There you go. Let's have a numbers round. Elizabeth, what is your number?
So my number is 170,000. And that is how many followers a TikTok guy named Carnivore Ray has. And he's a big proponent of the carnivore diet, which is now a thing. And the thesis behind it is that you only eat meat to the exclusion of everything else. And this is sort of an extension of all the kind of caveman memes that have been turned into exercise programs and, you know, the paleo diet, which is a little bit...
Wasn't that called paleo for a while?
No, you're allowed to eat vegetables and fruits under paleo.
Oh.
This is like nothing but meat.
Nothing
call it
but
the
meat?
BBE diet. Well, also butter. Beef, bacon, butter, and eggs. And so Carnivore Ray did a TikTok a while back where he said, you know, I'm going to make my favorite snack. And he rolled out a bunch of pieces of fatty bacon strips and then poured 2 sticks of butter over them. Froze them, and then, you know, cut them up and ate them like popsicles. And he said
Guys,
it tasted like
do not
candy.
Try this. Do not try this at home. This is a great way of becoming a social media influencer. It's also a great way of landing yourself in the hospital.
Isn't that what happened to Jordan Peterson? He went on an all-meat
diet. Well, I think his is like all-meat and Klonopin, which was not really
And he wound up in some like really weird hospital in Russia. Like
yes.
The whole story was just... really bizarre.
I think don't eat an all-meat diet. I'm going to say
don't
it right here.
Don't try this at home, people. Emily, what's your number?
I'm just thinking about those butter bacon popsicles.
Don't think about try not to think about it.
Thinking about it
can do you no good.
My number is $3.33. That is the last time I checked the share price of Peloton. And in 2021, Peloton stock hit $163. And so now it's $3. And yeah, this week, the CEO, Barry McCarthy, said he was stepping down. He's the CEO they brought in to replace the founder. I mean, this company has been, it's really remarkable. It had this like pandemic boom in 2020. And really, since then, it's just been struggling. Like, it's not like, oh, it just started struggling. It's been doing badly since at least late 2021, 2022.
So the Peloton story is super fascinating. If you look at it through the stock market lens, it is a complete disaster and an unmitigated failure.
But
if you look at it through the consumer lens, it still has like a 90 net promoter score or something.
Mm-hmm.
The people who use the Peloton bikes and who consume the Peloton media, they still really love it. And they still really love the instructors, and the instructors are still like big celebrities. And there's just this astonishing disconnect between a company that seems to do everything right in terms of getting people to love the product versus a company that just can't seem to make money at all. Partly because, of course, you know, the way it used to make money was by selling bikes. And now it has to pivot from selling bikes to selling subscriptions because you're not going to buy a second bike. And it turns out that like selling subscriptions, I guess, is harder or something. But like, there is this kind of cognitive disconnect there. Like, it's very rare to see a company doing this badly while people still love it as much as people love Peloton.
I think it's part of the like this thing that you like to talk about sometime, like the insatiable need for growth. Like when the pandemic first happened and Peloton had really huge growth because everyone was stuck at home and wanted to work out, they were like leaning into that so much. And that was just a huge mistake. Like if they had just stayed, somehow stayed small and not aimed for growth and just aimed to be, you know, the good brand that people loved and like treat its users well and innovate in that way. And not
and then ultimately like just bought by Amazon, which seems to be the inevitable endpoint for all of these things. And they would have just gone home rich.
Yeah, maybe now the end game for them is to get bought by Amazon, like you said, or even just taken private or something. Just get out of the stock market. You know, they don't belong there.
My number is 29%. And that is the proportion of Disney Plus TV views in the fourth quarter of 2023 that were Bluey.
Oh my God. Wow.
Bluey is almost a third of all Disney Plus TV viewing.
That's incredible. No one saw that coming. Everyone was like, Marvel this, Star Wars that. Nope. Three-year-olds, that's the target audience of Disney, as it should be.
Have either of you seen Bluey?
No.
No.
Me neither.
So I am friends with various people with small kids, and legitimately they all love Bluey. And they talk about like the last, like the Bluey finale, and they are so invested in the Bluey storyline, and they're super into the idea that Bluey's coming back. And everyone I know who watches Bluey, like when I'm, and I don't know any kids who watch Bluey, but I know a lot of grown-ups who watch Bluey, and they love it. They think it's great.
What is a Bluey?
It's a dog.
Is it blue?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
It's a blue dog. Am I right about that, Elizabeth?
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure
it is.
Blue dog.
I also think that this is a kind of allergic reaction to Paw Patrol, which was the worst kids, or still is the worst children's show ever, in my opinion. And Paw Patrol is kind of like
Bluey, and Bluey is... And Bluey is Australian, right?
Who can say?
Who knows?
It's your number.
Anyway, well done, Disney Plus, for managing to, you know, obliterate Star Wars and Pixar with Bluey. It's the new hotness for the.
How's there not
the
a Bluey ones. Movie in the works? There probably is, right?
There probably is. Yeah.
There could be like a Bluey Marvel kind of like mashup movie where the dog teams up with like the new Captain America or something.
Oh my God, can we just have Bluey making friends with Chewbacca and that'll be the ultimate buddy movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or Bluey and the Mandalorian or whatever. Yeah, there are so many opportunities here. Bluey and Baby Yoda. Okay, on which note, I'm just going to ask you all, you lovely listeners, please write in slatemoney@slate.com. What is your dream Bluey collab? Who should Bluey co-star in the movie with? Because... obviously, this needs to happen, but it does need to be Disney IP.
Also, how many ravioli do you think should be on a plate?
Exactly.
That's a good question.
We ask the important questions here at Slate Money. Write in slatemoney@slate.com. Stay tuned, all you lovely Slate Plus members, for us to talk about what Elon is doing to the supercharger network in Slate Plus. Otherwise, many thanks to Jared Downing and Shana Roth for producing, and we'll be back next week with more Slate Money.